Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of New Netherland Praatjes, the online podcast that is everything New Netherland. Today, our guest is Dennis Mica, one of the people who is most knowledgeable in the world about the topic of New Netherland, the Dutch colony of New Netherland. Dennis is the Associate for Education and Web Content at the New Netherland Institute. He's been Senior Scholar in Residence. He was longtime social studies teacher, curriculum coordinator, and chairman of the history department at Fox Lane High School in Westchester, New York. He's a fellow of the New Netherland Institute, the Holland Society of New York, and the New York Academy of History. Dennis, welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Russell.
We're going to talk, cover a range of topics, and what one thing that those that range of topics has in common is you. They are all interests of yours. So let's start by talking about your background. How did you come to New Netherland as a topic?
I'm a New York City boy. I grew up in New York City, born and raised in Queens. I went to Forest Hills Public Schools in New York City. Went to City University of New York when it was still free, if you can imagine that, and decided when I was there, I switched from an English major to a history major, seeing the light, and decided I wanted to, you know, go on and major in history and teach in college. And it was in graduate school that I really discovered New York City history, working with Patricia Bonamy, who was there, who ended up becoming my advisor and a good friend. So I guess, you know, my interest in New York City was always there, having grown up in the city, being aware of, you know, Dutch roots, but never really understanding much about it. I remember going to the Museum of the City of New York in elementary school, PS-144 field trip,
and seeing the model,
the Costello plan. Yeah. It was flat at the time rather than on the wall. And I remember that vividly, you know, but I really didn't understand much about it. And even in college, the training that I had as an undergraduate was mostly about New England and Chesapeake, when you really want to understand the origins of America. And taking some of Pat's courses, and then really kind of stimulating my interest, you know, that kind of what I knew about New York was the beginning. But it wasn't until I started, you know, back for my doctorate after, you know, teaching for many years, that I discovered a series of notarial records that had been translated by Simon Hart, abstracts that were in the collection of Historic Hudson Valley. And one of the courses that I had to take in NYU, an archives course, was to try to bring control over these loose documents that were just sitting there. So I was working with Jacob Judd, who was a historian that was working for Historic Hudson Valley at the time. And as I'm reading through these documents, I'm seeing a whole different side to what New Netherland history was like. I'm seeing the perspective of private merchants and what these individuals are doing and how, you know, their influence really made a difference on what happened in the colony. And that piqued my interest, and that became almost like a decades-long obsession, trying to understand what these people were doing.
And that leads right into basically our first topic, which is the private merchants and what they were doing in New Netherland. Traditionally, to the extent that New Netherland is sort of covered at all, it's kind of from the perspective of the West India Company. So you're kind of getting under the surface of that.
Exactly. I think one of the great values of looking at New Netherland history from the point of view of the individual merchants is it's a whole new lens to appreciate what was really going on at the time. Well, you saw it, you know, in the book that you wrote. You saw it's more than just the Dutch West India Company. It was, you know, the variety of individuals that are involved in doing the things that were important at the time. And so when you look at the private merchants, you're really seeing private entrepreneurship. You're seeing that individuals who are trying to prosper in the Dutch Atlantic world are really being more successful than, you know, the old paradigm would lend you to believe. So if you just focus on the West India Company and you fall into the popular stereotype of the West India Company was a failure, therefore the colony of New Netherland was a failure, therefore everybody in Manhattan was just waiting for the English to arrive to save them. That's really incorrect. It's really not true from the perspective of people on the ground. And when you view it from the lens of private merchants, you see them struggling, looking for profit, but having some success, some failure. But really the driving force behind the colony were these private entrepreneurs that are trying to make the colony successful.
And how did they operate? I mean, the from that perspective, then the colony's history divides differently. I mean, there are different sort of turning points having to do with when they become get a new lease on life, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think if you just look at the evolution of New Netherland from the perspective of the founding of the West India Company to the end, to the English arrival in 1664, then you're missing what's really changing for private merchants and changing for the development of the colony. Most people forget that right after Hudson, private merchants were involved in trying to exploit the riches of the Hudson Valley and the South River. Then when West India Company is founded in 1621, that changes, you know, the trajectory of the colony. But by 1639, the West India Company has given up its monopoly on the fur trade and opening up—
Under pressure,
yeah. But opening up the door, because they weren't being as successful as they could have been. They're always— I'm finding that the directors are always looking for new ways to try to make the colony prosperous. They're not always successful, and sometimes their changes come too quickly, you know, for adjustment to take place, but they're always looking for ways to make the colony prosperous. So 1639, when you open up the fur trade, you create these openings for private merchants, investors in the Netherlands that are looking for new opportunities.
And so just to stop you there, so at that moment then, what happens? What do these— I mean, how does it work? I mean, you're a small-scale trader, and you have an opening now because there's no longer this monopoly. So, I mean, specifically, how did they do it?
Well, you have the different. Well, Oliver Rink, for example, talked about several merchant families that are prosperous in Dutch trade who begin to reach out into the New Netherland trade. And so those families, the Verbruggers, the Hoornbecks, the Gabrys, I mean, these are families that begin to look for other ways of investing their money. They're involved in other parts of, you know, the Dutch Atlantic world, but they're also looking for other ways to invest money. So sometimes they find, they give money to factors, their representatives in New Netherland. And so the first merchants, that the indigenous merchant community that develop in Manhattan, are actually factors of these individual Amsterdam firms. They're not only tied to them, but they represent their interests.
So it's like they send out a branch manager.
Okay. Yeah,
well,
although the branch doesn't really exist yet. Uh-huh, they're kind of looking for ways to see if it can be profitable. Uh-huh. But every voyage is its own entity. So if one voyage doesn't work, they might try a second voyage, or they might not, or they might make adjustments and move to a different area of investment. So it really depends on what they find as being profitable. But over time, after 1639, when things begin to settle after the 1640s, by the 1650s, these individual merchants are operating on their own, as well as, you know, operating as agents or now partners with, you know, these Amsterdam firms. And they're not big firms, and they're private investors, you know, that can invest in a single voyage that might find profit in New Amsterdam. But gradually, by the 1650s, since you mentioned turning points, by the 1650s, these merchants that are beginning to see profitability, that it's possible that the colony by 1650, after the Dutch War for Independence ends and things begin to settle after 1648, there are ways of looking forward to the future that offers more promise than what might have existed before. And that's why the merchants are interested in creating a city government that will provide them with some stability. And as you say in Ireland, that 1653 is an important turning point for what happens in the history of New Netherland, because now you have a municipal government that's going to provide order and stability for the merchant community. And that's basically what the municipal government does.
And what are these private merchants, what are they dealing in? What are the main products they're trading?
Just about everything. So the fur trade opens up opportunities, and so they get involved in the fur trade, as well as the Dutch West India Company. The Dutch West India Company is still trading in furs, but they're collecting duties on the furs. So fur trade is still popular. By the 1650s, they begin to see other opportunities in other parts of the Atlantic world. So one thing that I think most people kind of ignore is the connection between developing New Netherland and the Chesapeake tobacco trade. And so what I find in by the late 1650s, early 1660s, even though there had been tobacco trade, you know, consistently in the 1630s and 40s between the Chesapeake colonies and Amsterdam, now the Manhattan merchants, the New Amsterdam merchants, are getting involved in being kind of a middleman for that trade. So they're using Manhattan as an entrepot for the Chesapeake tobacco trade, signing a treaty in 1660 between the government of New Netherland and the government of Virginia, you know, to continue this fur trade, to continue the tobacco trade to make it profitable. Negotiations are underway with Maryland, and Maryland is doing the same kind of thing. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but they're involved in the Maryland tobacco trade. They also get involved in trade in Curacao. Initially, in the 1650s, they're looking to trade salt, horses, dyewoods, but also then the merchants begin to ship grain down to and other kinds of foodstuffs, meat, peas, to support initially the garrison in Curacao. But then as Curacao becomes more of a slave entrepot for the Spanish colonies, the grain that was going to be produced in New Netherland is going to be shipped to Curacao to feed the slaves while they're waiting, you know, for their transshipment. So it's they're also involved in, you know, importing goods from the Netherlands, and there's some trade with New England. So they're getting involved every place. Every place there's an opportunity, they try to make some money. They're not always successful. You know, they have some issues at certain points in time. For example, wanting to trade with Curacao, they don't have enough boats to actually conduct that on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And so by the time of the English conquest in 1664, they're beginning to turn that around. Same thing with the Chesapeake, and same thing with what's happening in the fur trade. As they adjust, you know, they're looking for new opportunities and new trade goods are used. When they're having trouble with a bad year in fur trade, they're importing planks and boards that they're going to ship not only to the South River, but also to Curacao. So this, there's a description. I have a quote from, I guess, somebody actually described the merchants in New York. William Temple is describing this as, "They buy infinitely, but 'tis to sell again, either upon improvement of the commodity or at a better market." William Smith, who's writing about merchants in 1757, actually talks about merchants as resembling a hive of bees gathering honey for others, capable of great boldness. I mean, even though it's a century later, that's essentially what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And to me, they really begin to set the foundation for what is private entrepreneurship in New York City. Mm-hmm. And again, if you don't look at the history from the lens of private merchants, you're going to miss that. Why does New York always be, why is New York a global city? Well, mm-hmm. part of it, I mean, it's not a direct relation, but part of it is the precedents that are established by the private merchant community in New Amsterdam,
yeah,
who survived, by the way, you know, beyond 1664. You know, 1664, go ahead, sorry.
No.
1664 is another one of those turning points that I think people misinterpret. If you look at what the actual articles of transfer say, and they're more in articles of transfer than articles of capitulation. Not much is being surrendered in these articles of surrender. More is being protected than is being surrendered. Those articles of transfer actually preserve what had been established, you know, by the private merchants and by the West India Company, and it allows that same kind of community from the 1650s and 1660s to survive and prosper in the 1670s and 1680s. So there's a continuity rather than an end of something. And the way to really appreciate the persistence of Dutch culture, I think, is to appreciate what really happens with 1664. It's not an end to anything. It's a continuation. It's a protection of what already existed.
Just to back up and talk about, in particular, Virginia and the trade that they negotiated a treaty so that they could send goods to New York Harbor, to New Amsterdam and then have them shipped to Europe. What was in it for the English? Why was it better for them to do it via New Amsterdam?
Because the best market for tobacco was the market through Amsterdam and Rotterdam. Uh-huh. The English market was not as good. The English in the 1640s were going through their civil war. When Cromwell is firmly established in the 1650s, the first of the Navigation Acts is established in the 1650s. And again, that prevents tobacco being sent to the market that's most profitable. So the Virginians are actually looking for ways of making money and finding an appropriate market. And the best way to do that is by working through either direct contacts with Amsterdam and Rotterdam or with the merchants in New Amsterdam. And they're finding that New Amsterdam and New Netherland is the perfect channel for their tobacco. It's not the only one, you know, but it's the perfect channel. Mm-hmm. They also begin to link that with slaves. And then we'll talk a little bit more about that, I guess, later.
Yeah. But. Everybody, you see in different places the quote that in New Amsterdam, everybody's a trader. Everybody has
right.
a piece
Acacia's
of the
Silla, yeah.
Yeah. So how did that work? How was it that, you were, I don't know, a barmaid or a farmer or a wheelwright or whatever? I mean, how was it that you had the option or the opportunity to get a piece of shipment?
Well, if you imagine that that every commercial investment was for a specific period of time and a specific voyage, a red ride, for example, a charter party was made. Who was going to invest in the charter party? Who was going to put cargo on board the ship? Who is going to invest in that cargo? So you could have large-scale investors who would invest, you know, thousands, and then you could have small investors who could invest, you know, 10 or 20 guilders. They would still be a piece of that. And that mm-hmm. same thing happened in New Amsterdam because they're buying and selling. And so they find a way of getting a piece of something, and so they are investing in that. They'll buy land. They'll trade their grain for beaver, or they'll take beaver in return for grain and then sell the beaver to a merchant. You know, so a small individual farmer or even a blacksmith or a baker might take a beaver in exchange for a service, and then they'll sell that beaver to a merchant and then get something in return for
that. And
that
actually gets into the issue of units of currency in New Amsterdam. I mean, it wasn't, we tend to think that people went around with money in their pocket and gave mm-hmm. somebody a coin or whatever, and there was some of that, but it was a much more complex situation, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, very, very few actual coins. Uh-huh. But it was a more highly sophisticated exchange system than I think is normally perceived. When you see them talking about beaver, when you see them talking about hogsheads of tobacco, when you see them using Indian zeewont, Indian wampum, it's all calculated in Dutch guilders. So they're very.
So they had one baseline, which
was the baseline was the Dutch guilder. That was currency in New Netherland, but currency in Amsterdam was a little bit different, a little bit more higher priced. But they made all those calculations. If you look at the few account books that have survived, you can see that the account books are very specific in terms of the amount that's being bought and sold in terms of guilders. And they'll say exactly what that is. There was a regulation of the price of beaver, for example, and regulation of the price of wampum, because this was the currency. It was called commodity currency. You didn't have gold and silver. If it was around, it was very rare. Mm-hmm. But nobody's jingling, change in their pockets.
Right, right. So if you were buying a beer or if you were buying a cheese or something, I mean, it was all calculated in guilders, but then the transaction would happen in something else.
Right, and you would probably have an account.
You would have an account with someone.
Yeah, you'd have an account.
So it would be written down, and then
so
later you'd settle
it
up.
It would get settled up, and it could be settled in a variety of different ways. And the settlement of that account was what the court was useful for. So if you didn't have a city court that would provide for the settlement of accounts, you couldn't really conduct business. If you thought, if I lent money to someone or let somebody run up an account with me, whether it's for trade or whether it's for beer at the local tavern, if you can't guarantee that it's going to be repaid, there's no sense in getting involved in business.
But and agree on a baseline, how, yes. And an amount, whether it's, one beaver is worth this much.
Yes.
Exactly. Sewant or this many guilders or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
There was a universal measure. And that's what, I mean, you see in the records too, that Stuyvesant is weighing in or whoever it is weighing in on regulating periodically. They had to reset
Because they were always afraid of inflation.
Right.
You know, because if you flood the market with loose wampum, for example, you're going to devalue the value, you devalue the wampum, which is used as a stable currency. Mm-hmm. There was constant debate over whether or not a beaver is really going to get 8 guilders, which was like the standard measure in the Netherlands. If it's only going to get 6, then what's it going to be like in, what are you going to use it for in New Amsterdam? Mm-hmm. So there was a very, very serious concern about the value of this commodity currency, the fluctuation of like a money market in essence. So it's not a barter economy. I think that's another myth that people have about it. It's not a barter economy. It's a very sophisticated accounting system. And financial system.
And this is kind of something that I think I've never voiced, actually, but now that you're talking about this, it's something that's been in the back of my mind. If you're, you come off a ship and you're here for a short time, here meaning in New Amsterdam, so you're not in this system, how do you get anything, how do you get things? I mean, you go to somebody and say, here, I got a beaver, now will you, I mean, how do you get a room and get you know, food and drink? And
generally, you know, you've made some arrangements before you arrive here. So you have some idea about what's going on. You might have a relative that could help establish you. It depends on who you are as well. I mean, if you're one of those factors that represents a business firm, you're going to have contacts with other merchants and they're going to know who you are. Mm-hmm. If you're someone that's arriving as an indentured servant, you have a contract. Mm-hmm. And so you know who you're going to be working for. If you're going to the South River and you're just part of, you know, Plaquois colony, you have some idea about what the community is going to be like. So it isn't one single process that people follow. It depends on your circumstance when you're leaving. But you establish accounts, and you establish accounts with family members, or you establish accounts with a local, you know, vendor or someone that you become a tenant farmer. You make an agreement, and the agreement could be notarized before a notary, and you say, I will work for you, or I will pay you this amount of money if you let me work the land for X amount of years. And, you know, so it's a contractual arrangement. People are willing to engage in contracts with other people. Because they know that those contracts can be enforced. And that's the stability that's given to, you know, this city in the wilderness.
And hence, once again, the importance of an actual municipal government that can...
Exactly. The West India Company tried to provide those services initially, but it became too onerous for the company. And so I think one of the reasons, I don't know if you would agree with that, but one of the reasons why there was an agreement for a city charter, because Stuyvesant was overwhelmed by the cases that he was having to deal with, sometimes a little petulant about.
So it's an interesting period between 1640, when the monopoly, the West India Company monopoly, vanishes, and 1653, because in that period, the company no longer has a monopoly, and yet it's still trying to manage all of this. Is that so? That's what you're talking about, saying that Stuyvesant had a harder and harder time acting on behalf of the company.
As you know, those initial merchant factors that are involved. I mean, people like Hover Lookermans, they're working for, you know, the private investment families. They're looking for ways of making a profit, and they want their contracts and their financial disputes to be resolved by the company. There's a lot of other things that are going on in the 1640s that make it more difficult for trade to continue. But by the end of 1648, when they see that there's a future, that the international situation has begun to change.
Right, good point. Because in 1648, then the Dutch government has legitimacy.
It
is, because we should say, there's a war. The Dutch are fighting a war of independence,
which ends in 1648,
against Spain throughout this whole period. And then in 1648, suddenly they are truly a nation in their own right, and from that moment, then there's a different kind of level of legitimacy on the whole.
Right, and the West India Company takes a different view of things as well. I mean, they're not fighting a war, essentially. You know, they're looking for other ways of making the company prosperous. So, you know, that's why 1653 is so significant, because it doesn't take place in a vacuum. I mean, you can see why it's happening. It happens because the international situation changes, because the prospects for increasing commerce increase, and the people are resident in the town. You know, they understand what municipal culture in the Dutch model really means to them, and they want to create that in New Amsterdam.
And they see, this is home, I've got a future here, my children, and so on. So
now, even Stuyvesant, it's kind of interesting that I think Stuyvesant grows into that role of being a Manhattanite, Because when it's after 1664 and after he defends himself, you know, a few years later, he comes back and he lives in Manhattan and he becomes a voice in the community. He articulates, you know, certain things that the merchants had been interested in before he dies in the 1670s. So it's kind of interesting. I think there's an evolution for Stuyvesant as well as the merchant
community. I think that is a good point. It's a very interesting thing because he was holding on to this position and this way of, in a way, he had this old view. I mean, that's the feeling I get of his role and the company's role, and then he eventually, after the English takeover, has to go back and defend his behavior, and then he comes back.
Exactly. I think he's a much more sympathetic figure to the merchants than is normally perceived. I mean, he's not, you know, he has his moments where he's, you know, he fits into the stereotype, but he has other moments, what I've discovered, that he knows that the prosperity of the colony is going to depend on the prosperity of the private merchants. Mm-hmm. If they're not doing well, if they're not trading, then where is the colony going to go? I mean, he recognizes the points of agriculture, of course, but, you know, he realizes that New York is always a global city. Manhattan is a global city. And so he needs to support the merchant community. And I find that, you know, gradually from the 1650s into the 1660s, he really begins to favor the merchant community. And he's stuck. He's stuck in between what he knows will allow the merchants to prosper and what the West India Company is asking him to do. And he tries to walk a fine line because he recognizes his duties there. But he knows what the merchants need. Mm-hmm. And he recognizes how he can support them, and he tries to as much as he can. Mm. But, you know, he's a company man, and so he has to defend himself. But I think I'd love to know more about his private investments. You know, we have glimpses of that. But I think that's part of why he remains. I think he's invested heavily himself. And he stays because he sees, you know, the colony prospering. And the merchants stay. The same people that are, as I mentioned before, the same people that make the colony work in the 1650s and 1660s stay. There isn't a mass.
You're talking about in the English period.
In the English period, yeah. There isn't a mass exodus of Dutch merchants from so-called English Manhattan. They remain, and the English governors know that if they're going to keep the colony prospering, they've got to work with the same Dutch merchants that
have
been there.
And this presumably plays a role in the decision by the community member at the moment whenever Stuyvesant wants to fight the English, and people talk him down and say no because they think this is our town and it's going to get destroyed.
Yeah, I think there's a deeper story there. Uh-huh. I wonder sometimes. I know that Stuyvesant's a very practical man, a very realistic man, a very smart man, and I think he recognizes that he wasn't really going to be able to fight. But every action, because you're a prominent person in the company, every action is going to have to be justified to the company. So if he can let everybody believe that he was willing to fight, even though he knew it was futile, I think that would be reported.
So he was so that later, whenever he has to face the company, he could say, "Look, I tried."
I think so. I mean, you know, to what degree was he sincere in that? Yeah. You know, I think he recognizes that it was difficult. He also knew it was coming. You know, there was no doubt that the English were going to arrive. There was talk actually several years before 1664 that the English might be on their way, and they knew as early as January that the English were coming. By July, they knew that the fleet was on the way. He knew what his ammunition situation was like, but he also knew, you know, from talking to the merchants and from talking to the negotiating team, essentially, you know, that the English said, including John Winthrop, that there's a way to make a deal here and to keep the colony prospering. You know, he had to do his job as director general, and I think he did. I think he explained it well, but I think he knew the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. But again, when you view it from the point of view of the merchants, you see what he's trying to do. He's trying to keep the colony moving. When the merchants petition him for different privileges, he grants what he can, but he forwards other things on to the West India Company waiting for their approval. And it's almost as if, you know, what I've been discovering lately is that the merchants are more and more disappointed by what the company is restricting them to do. And not that they're happy with
what
the English
takeover. When are you talking about? What period?
By the 1660s. Uh-huh. You know, they're restricting their involvement in the slave trade, for example. They're limiting their ability to trade as freely as they would have liked.
They're putting more restraints on them, more constraints.
Well, they're changing policy, you know, with the slave trade. They initially say that, you know, the slave trade is very connected to the tobacco trade. And so they say initially that you can't trade slaves with Curacao. Then you can, but you can't let them leave the colony. Then when they see that it's connected to tobacco, they, to, the tobacco trade, they say, okay, you can trade. But then as they begin to see that the South River colony of New Amstel, which is now turned over to the city of Amsterdam completely, that they're the ones that are going to be the entrepot for the slave trade in Maryland, that they say, no, you can't trade slaves freely. It has to go through the company, and it can only be used for agriculture. So they change their policy very quickly. And it's almost as if the merchants are saying, well, we need some consistency. We need some stability here. And we're trying to work with you, but we can't. And so I think it's I'm not really ready to say this, that the merchants are happy with the English takeover, but they see new opportunities because mm-hmm. they've dealt with imperial governments that are very weak in New Netherland before. They realize what will make trade prosper, and they understand the English situation very well. They understand what the English are experiencing. The English governors know that if they're going to make the colony prosper, they have to encourage trade. And so these entrepreneurs, you know, find a way of making it work after the English take it over. And I think they learn that by working with the West India Company.
So by that point, the merchants themselves see the flaws from their perspective inherent in the Dutch kind of weak confederation government.
I think with the West India Company, I don't think they make a connection about the actual government in the Netherlands. I think it's the control of the West India Company, you know, more specifically than what the States General.
Uh-huh. We're going to get into slavery, but I just wanted to, while we're still on this, talk a little bit about Dutch. I mean, you're the importance of Dutch municipal culture, the city. How important city was and the role that the government played in the city in the Netherlands, and then how that gets transferred.
Yeah, I think we missed that. I know that, you know, when I was first studying history in high school and college, it was always when you thought about the English imperial system, you thought about a pretty effective imperial system. When you think about anybody establishing colonies, you think the Dutch established the colonies. Well, who is really establishing a colony? When you think about the Pilgrims, I mean, imagine that the Pilgrims who are coming from Leiden are actually a private group that are looking for ways to arrive. They're not part of an English imperial system, because in the 1620s, there is no real English imperial system that's an effective colonizing agent. So I think the same thing is happening in the Netherlands. The Netherlands is a republic. It's a confederation. They're experimenting, but their experimentation comes from, you know, private investment, the individualism that you speak about too. I think that plays a real role in colonization. And so when people are leaving their homeland, they're leaving a homeland that's not a strong national government. Like, you can't equate, you know, 17th century the Netherlands or even 17th century England to 21st century America. There's no powerful government. There isn't this omnipotency in national government that we now associate with national government. So you can't impose that on the 17th century. What's really important for the people in the Netherlands is their local government, is their municipal government. And that's what they're concerned about. That's what gives them stability and order. That's what they relate to. If you travel, and I know you have, but I mean, if somebody travels in the Netherlands, one of the most prominent structures in every town is their stadhuis, is their state house, their
city hall.
The city hall. And that's the same thing that's created in New Amsterdam. So it's the city government that they relate to. It's the city culture that's important to them. It's the members of the upper classes, for example, that are going to control the city government. In this case, the merchants are going to control the city government.
They're going to make sure the trade
happens. And they're going to make sure that, you know, the processes of city government will support trade. There's never, you know, this question about free trade is never absolutely free, because if you don't have a government that's going to enforce contracts, as I said, a government that's going to provide that stability, a government that provides quality controls, they inspect tobacco, they inspect grain, they make sure that the measurements are accurate. These are done by the municipal governments, and it's the same tradition in the Netherlands. The weighhouses in Dutch cities, port cities, are fascinating. When you take a look at them, you see the huge weigh scales. They're almost monuments to ordered commerce, mm-hmm. essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the city culture that's transmitted into New Amsterdam and a direct descendant of Dutch cities. The New Englanders, it's interesting that the New Englanders in Boston at one point complained that they wished they had a city government like existed in New Amsterdam, because the city government provided them order. The township governments were not the same thing. Mm. Boston was a town, mm-hmm. not a city.
To what extent did that carry over to Beverwijk?
I'm not sure.
Which became Albany, the second second city, so to speak.
I think you find the same municipal culture because it's set up in a year before in 1652 as a city government. I think it's providing order and stability for the trade in Beverwijk, but it's New Amsterdam was the staple port. And so that becomes, you know, the focus. It's the capital because it's the port through which all the trade should pass. So I think that's what creates a more vibrant city culture. There are more people in New Amsterdam. There's more going on in New Amsterdam. But it's not that the court records of Beverwijk don't show you the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, we have to move on to other topics.
Okay.
And you've been veering into the topic of slavery and the colony. So I wanted to, I think you have been uncovering, the topic of slavery in the Dutch colony of New Netherland is, I think, one of the most richly misunderstood things. And I think people make the understandable mistake of looking back through the 19th century when slavery was this sort of full-blown institution in America, and reading then 17th century through that prism, which isn't fair, so to speak. Unpack it a little bit. What's wrong with that picture, and what did it look like?
I think considering slavery, if we talk about the institution of slavery, you know, the legal institution, it has a long history in the American colonies. Not particularly unique to New Amsterdam. It's also the case in the Chesapeake colonies as well. But slavery evolves as an institution. It's not like Gone with the Wind, the antebellum South. That's several hundred years after slavery is first introduced in the American colonies. So if you imagine an institution evolving over 200 years, what it looks like at the end of that 200 years or 250 years by the time of the Civil War is very different from what it looked like when it began in the early 1600s. So I think trying to impose, like you said, trying to impose that vision of the antebellum South and plantation slavery on what was really happening in the 17th century is not only unfair, but it's seriously misleading.
So slaves, the first slaves come into New Netherland on Spanish ships that they've captured.
Right.
So
or
the
as
West
prizes.
India, as prizes.
Right.
Not necessarily
on Spanish ships, but captured from Spanish ships.
So the West India Company kind of backs into the slave trade and then says, all right, maybe we can make money at this.
Well, I think the West India Company had been more active in the slave trade, but the first slaves that arrive in New Amsterdam are not a result of a deliberate cargo of slaves that are sent from the West India Company. Mm-hmm. The West India Company is clearly active in the slave trade. You know, certainly after they take control of Brazil and they take control of the Portuguese colonies in West Africa, Elmina, for example. So by the 1630s, I think the West India Company is seriously committed to the slave trade, but not with New Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. You know, New Amsterdam, that's going to come later. So the first slaves that actually arrive in New Amsterdam arrive as captured prize cargoes from Spanish ships because, as we said before, there's a war going on between the Netherlands and Spain. They're capturing Spanish ships, and they're trying to sell those, whatever they've captured. So we know that they're from Spanish ships because we have records of that. We also know some of the names of the first slaves that first arrived. We know that they have Spanish names, whether they were part of what Ira Berlin called Atlantic Creoles, they'd been around for a while, or whether or not they were newly imported from Africa. We don't really know for sure. But we do know that as they arrive, it's not part of the plan. And so what does the West India Company do? We know that there's a slave quarters, so to speak. On the Manatus map, it's identified. We know that there's an overseer for slaves. But it's not, when you use the word overseer, it's not the same as an overseer that you would find in the antebellum South. I mean, it's someone who's going to literally oversee what slaves are going to be used for. We know what the first enslaved people were, what labor they were involved in. We know that they were involved in building the fort, but they were not alone in building the fort. They were probably helpful in building the wall, but they were not alone in building the wall. They were involved in farming. They were skilled craftsmen. The company at one point wants to teach them crafts so that, and they make a point saying that they're very adept at doing that by the 1640s and 1650s. So these are people that are laborers initially, not part of the plan. And the institution, therefore, begins to evolve from that. And one of the most interesting and unique features of the institution of slavery in New Netherland is this idea about half freedom. We rather use the term conditional freedom now because not really half free. But what's interesting is that the people that had who petitioned for their freedom. So imagine this. These are enslaved Africans who had been living in New Amsterdam, New Netherland, for about 17 or 18 years, who know enough about their environment and the government under which they operate to petition their government. Imagine slaves organizing petitions. So several slaves petition the West India Company for their freedom, and the West India Company grants them conditional freedom. And that's a very unique feature, you know, that slaves are actually petitioning for that. And their reasoning is that we've been working for you long enough. And the company says, okay, because now you have families, it's going to be hard for us to pay for you. So we'll give you your freedom and we'll let you have land, but we'll hold on to your children, but they end up freeing their children later on. But you have to pay us a quit rent. You have to be available for labor when we need it, but we'll pay you if we need your labor. So that's a very, very unique situation. And we know that these first few, no more than about 11 and their wives, actually get land north of the city in what's now Washington Square Park. These are the first free Africans that are living in Manhattan. And they live there, you know, we don't know exactly what happened to many of them, but they live there for a long time. And this idea, this practice of slaves petitioning is something that continues right up to 1664. As a matter of fact, one of the most interesting petitions that I've seen is that several slaves who had been recently granted their conditional freedom earlier in 1664, when the English fleet is in the harbor, they petition Stuyvesant for their full freedom because they're worried about what the English are going to be like. And Stuyvesant grants them their freedom.
There's sort of a hurried, well, let's get this done.
Yeah,
that's what it feels like.
But again, that's, right? You know, it's what we had talked about before about the voices of those that are enslaved. We don't really know everything that they're thinking, but this is very telling, isn't it? It really shows that they have the right to petition, and they're using it because they recognize the situation. The people that are enslaved actually have rights while they're still enslaved. They can marry in the Dutch Reformed Church initially. They can bring suit in court. And so this is something that you wouldn't normally expect in any kind of slave society. But slavery in New York, then, after the English conquest, slavery begins to change and evolve. And it really begins to become more of a hardened institution by the 18th century with the slave revolts that take place in the early part and then by 1741. And then with the heavy influx of slaves, you know, that's when you find a larger trade in slaves that are coming into the North. And again, imagining Northern slavery is something that's very difficult for Americans to perceive. You know, what are they doing? Where are the plantations in Manhattan? You know, how are they doing that? Where's the cotton being grown? You know, it's not really used for that. It's the Dutch actually, I think, established the tradition of, or helped build on the tradition of using enslaved labor for farming, which is what they were used for in the Dutch West India Company. And then one or two slaves are still being used by Dutch farmers in the Hudson Valley right up until, you know, gradual emancipation at the end of the 18th century.
And so back to within the lifespan of New Netherland, there were slaves who were owned by the company, by the West India
Yes.
Company, and then there were also individually owned
Yes.
slaves.
We don't know exactly how many. You know, we think that the number is far smaller than what's normally perceived. We think that the West India Company has fewer slaves because they have to support them and pay for them. So it's not like a large, when you hear about a slave quarters, it's not a large slave quarters that could be holding hundreds of slaves. The West India Company can't afford to do that. There's one very telling document that Charlie Gehring just shared with me. The company is looking to search a ship that's accused of carrying smuggled goods. And so in this one translation that Charlie just made, he said that they say that all the slaves of the company are going to be loaded on this small boat to go out to the ship and search for the smuggled cargo. Now, how many slaves are you going to get on a small boat if these are all the company mm-hmm. slaves? And he double-checked that translation. It says, yes, they're talking about all the company slaves. So there are a small number of slaves that are owned by the company. Individuals, it's hard to know how many they own. If they do, we have records of several slave auctions that are taking place in New Amsterdam in the 1660s. We know that there was one in 1655. A lot of those slaves were sold to a Virginian, Edward Scarborough, that happened to be in town at the time. But these are, you know, small numbers. They're purchasing one or two. These are prominent merchants that are buying them. Are they keeping them? Are they using them for, you know, their personal households? Are they, we don't know what they're using them for. But again, they're buying people. you know, which is another thing when you try to figure out how can you imagine the purchase of a person at an auction. It's a horrifying thought, but then you're given contradictory evidence that shows that one person who's purchasing a slave is purchasing a female African with her child. So the that family is not being split, it's being kept, but they're putting values on individuals. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to really know what they're thinking about that what the enslavers are thinking about the people they're enslaving. Mm-hmm. But some very telling moments there, you know, when you're buying a human being, that's hard to understand.
There's a lot of there's a frustration with doing history that you see certain cold details, but you want to get at the why and the what was in people's heads and all that, and it's a very hard thing.
Yeah, you don't have the evidence. You can suspect, but so there are different pieces that we try to pull together to try to understand what the different perspectives are. If the enslaved are petitioning, these are residents of Manhattan, but the new enslaved Africans that are arriving, they're there temporarily. Maybe they're viewed differently. Mm-hmm. They're no longer residents of the community. Maybe it's not a purely racist, you know, perspective. Maybe it's viewing people as commodities that are transitioning through the city. And actually, they use the word, in some of the documents, they're calling them pieces of Negroes, meaning there's a piece that you're buying and selling
products.
Like a product, which is, you know, a horrifying thought. And yet, with some of the residents, there's a case of one of the merchants is making sure that he purchases someone who had been the wife of someone who had been enslaved so that they could stay together. So there, you know, we don't really know. Like you said, we love to know more about what these people are thinking, but it's hard. We just get these snippets of evidence.
So there's a sense that you have that there were sort of two categories. One, slaves who may then eventually get conditional freedom who had been in the colony for a long time and therefore are kind of a known entity. And then slaves that come in and then go out and they're seen more as like a product.
I think there's, you know, that's one of the things that they struggle with. You know, how are we going to view if now these people that are arriving, and they're arriving in small numbers, by the way, it's not, one of the things that I've discovered recently is that New Amsterdam doesn't really become a major slave trading entrepot in the Dutch period. It just doesn't, from the evidence that I've seen. But we can get back to that if you like. But it's when you're beginning to view slaves as commodities, then your attitude begins to change. And we find that reflected in a line from one of the Dutch ministers, Salines, who actually says in the 1660s that when enslaved Africans had been admitted to the Dutch Reformed Church, they have to profess their understanding of Dutch of Christian doctrine rather than just they have to understand they have to be literate they have to understand, you know, the Bible. But he complains that the parents of these Negroes, use his words, are just doing this because they want their children to be free. And that's like a perversion of the doctrine. But, you know, I mean, any parent would, of course, want the best for their children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so where is that attitude coming from? You know, that attitude you find, maybe it's just an individual one, but it's beginning to surface in the 1660s. And maybe that's a reflection of the contradiction between viewing people as commodities and viewing people as members of the community. And so I haven't resolved that yet. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. There is one, I guess, kind of iconic image of slavery that you have very nicely unpacked because it has skewed this picture. It's given a certain false picture of what slavery was in the colony. And, you know, this is a conversation. It's not we don't have the picture in front of us, but can you talk about it?
Which one are we talking about? We talk about
the image with the colony and the slaves in the background and so on.
Okay, yeah, this is one. I mean, you can if you Google slavery in New Amsterdam, you're going to get this picture. There are two. It's an engraving. There are two people, a man and a woman, in the foreground. The man is not well dressed, you know, but he's clearly not a pauper, who seems to be exchanging something, offering something to a woman who looks like she's going to accept it, but she's might be offering something in return. And in the background, right behind those two people, you see what look like enslaved Africans. But what they're carrying, too bad we don't have the picture, but what they're carrying on their head and how they're dressed is kind of confusing because they're relatively unclothed. And then you see a picture of New Amsterdam in the background. But right before the picture of New Amsterdam, you see what almost looks like palm trees. So it's a very confusing image, even though it says New Amsterdam up on top. But what I found in looking at where this image came from, the image is in the New York Public Library. It was part of the Stokes collection. And it's actually very similar to another image that was published in 1700 in Allard's, one of Carolus Allard's collections of images of the world in 1700, and major cities all the way across the world. And the image that they show of Barbados and the capital of Barbados is the exact same image. So where does this one come from? It just, except instead of having New Amsterdam above it, it has, you know, it says English English tobacco growers in Barbados. Now, there weren't tobacco growers in Barbados in the late 17th century. There are more tobacco growers earlier. So when does this image really come from, even though it's published in 1700? But it's exactly the same image, except for, you know, with the people that are enslaved, exactly the same. The two figures are exactly the same, but the background is different and the labeling is different. So we don't really know what this image was. It's more likely that it was not meant to represent slavery in New Amsterdam. It was just typical of what many of the Dutch publicists would do. They would use an image and they keep reusing it and moving it around and substituting different pieces. One thing that I thought was very telling in this Carolus Allard collection, it was actually colored. So the images are beautiful images, and they're all in color. But when they portray African cultures and African cities, the coloring is black, deliberately black. And when they portray these particular, we think that they're slaves, the coloring is brown. So some people have speculated that they were more natives of Barbados, Indian natives, than they were slaves. So again, it just adds to the confusion of that image. Mm-hmm. But again, people see New Amsterdam of it, so they assume that these are New Amsterdam slaves. And you know,
and one image ends up having a lot of power.
Oh, yeah. And that image is used every place, even on the cover of some books. Uh-huh. You know, so.
We don't have much time left, but I wanted to get into the curriculum. We're shifting gears here. It's something that you've been involved in for several years now, is efforts to give the subject of New Netherland its rightful place, especially in the New York State curriculum. When students study history, that's part of it. So
yeah, it was always part of New York State history. Right. You know, it was always included, especially in fourth and seventh grade. It was always there, and I think the last time that what were called the like scope and sequence, the frameworks for the curriculum, the last time that was done was in the mid-1990s, 1996, I believe. And then so they were trying to revise that because it had been long overdue, and let's revise it. But when the state is involved in revising curriculum, especially now in this current educational environment, they were trying to link it to the so-called Common Core. So as they're in the middle of all these changes, things were adjusted, and it looked like New Netherland was cut. But happily, you know, the New York State Education Department offered public review. Here's what we're thinking of doing, offering time for public comment. And so it's in the course of that public comment that, you know, many of us contacted them and said, is there some way that we can bring the Dutch back to the curriculum? And they were receptive to that. Ultimately, it's a long, ugly story, but, you know, ends up happily in the end. So the fourth and seventh grade curriculum, the frameworks definitely include information about the Dutch influence. 11th grade, not so much, you know, and I think there's a weakness in what's offered in the 11th grade, because how can you ignore what existed in earlier grades and not even talk about it in the 11th grade? And I think part of that comes from the fact that when you're trying to put a lot together and you're having a large bureaucracy do it, you know, some things kind of get lost in the shuffle. And I think it's unfortunate that New Netherland could have been, but, you know, happily it's not.
And I mean, you're being a little bit self-effacing there, but I mean, this is, you know, the New Netherland Institute, you're the education associate for it, and you had this role in the of saying, hey, wait a second, this is a lot with any bureaucracy. It's a lot of work to get to sort of grab people by the collar and say, wait a second, this is an important piece of history that might slip by the wayside. And so this is, I won't put it on you and say, look at what Dennis Micah did, but this is something that the New Netherland Institute has been involved in preserving and making sure that this is not only preserved, but is kind of refurbished the way this is presented.
Absolutely. You know, I certainly wasn't alone in doing this. We had the support of everybody in the Institute. We had the support of of the Dutch Consul General, Rob de Vos, who ultimately, you know, was influential in getting that message across. But then, too, New York State was finally receptive to that. I'm not sure how the bureaucracy worked, but, you know, it ended up working, you know, better than it could have been. So, yeah, I think, you know, the happy story, I'm trying to be more positive than negative, but the happy story is that the pressure worked and people heard, you know, legitimate criticism and they adjusted to that. And so, you know, it's not great, but it's certainly better than excluding that. And I think that's a problem with what we know about New Netherland. There's so much that we can contribute to the public discourse about the evolution of American history that grows out of New Netherland. It's not exclusively that at all, but it certainly relates to New Netherland. And I think becoming more aware of that is something that we're trying to, in the New Netherland Institute, New Netherland Research Center, are trying to get the word out, especially for teachers who are starving for information. The teachers are looking for things, you know, to give to their classrooms, and they're eager to get it, and they're eager to learn new things. And I think we're happy to see that things are changing, that things are moving in the right direction.
You sent me an email with some notes, and you had this great line in it. You said, "Too much misinformation about New Netherland is too easily available."
Yes. Well, you know, if you can't Google New Netherland, you know, you have to go to reputable New Netherland sites, because too much stuff that's out there is just horrible, you know, and I think you have to be careful of it. And I think sometimes when people look for things, they are uncritical about what their sources are. So anybody who's listening to this broadcast, if you want the truth about New Netherland, go first to the New Netherland Institute website. You'll get more accurate information there than you will at any other place. Don't just Google and don't go to Wikipedia.
It's a subject that has misinformation. I'm starting with Washington Irving. He's the original misinformationalist about New Netherland.
Exactly. And he's very entertaining, but he's no historian.
Yeah. So. Before we finish, tell us what you're working on.
I'm working on putting all this stuff into a book about it'll be about Manhattan merchants in the 17th century, crossing that 1664 dividing line, looking at private entrepreneurship, merchants working with their city government, and really creating the foundations of New York City. New York City is a center of entrepreneurship, a global trade center, and I think the foundations of that are laid in 17th century Manhattan.
When will you finish?
Good question.
I hate to be asked that question. So
I'm working regularly, so hopefully it'll be sooner than later. How's that?
Very good. All right, Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you.